Welcome back to the Frozen Frontiers podcast. I'm your hostess, Tracy Walmer. This is a podcast that concentrates on the North American fur trade from approximately the 1500s to around 1840 when the fur trade died out. We talk about the people and the places and the events that shaped the North American continent, and we try to put history into a better perspective. Today, we're going to take a journey into the heartland of North America. Let's travel down the Ohio River, watching with excitement and more than a little trepidation as the burgeoning town of Pittsburgh fades into the distance. Our canoe glides past the thickly forested Appalachian Mountains and across the rolling hills of the Ohio River Basin. Our journey on this river will take us past 1,000 miles of pristine land that will someday become the states of West Virginia, Kentucky, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, and Missouri. This land is untouched by humans, for now. Animals are plentiful here, like bison and the elk grazing on the plains of Pennsylvania, or the grizzlies and black bears browsing on the edges of the ancient hardwood forests of Kentucky. After 1,000 miles, we reach the confluence with the mighty Mississippi River. Expansive marshes and open plains surround us, and out of those plains, great mounded earthworks rise up into the clear skies. Before the white man came to North America, tens of thousands of indigenous people called the Mississippi River Basin home. Many of the smaller tribes gathered together in an alliance with their neighbors. The Cahokia, the Kaskaskia, the Peoria, the Chincoa. All told, 13 tribes banded together to form the Illini, or the Illinois Confederacy. These tribes covered a territory stretching from Lake Michigan all the way down the Mississippi River and even into Arkansas. These people are referred to by anthropologists as the Mound Builders. Now, within this vast unspoiled wilderness, the Mound Builders established trading hubs, such as the one at Old Kaskaskia Village, which we sometimes today call Grand Village, near present-day Utica, Illinois. Like the pyramids in Egypt, or the temples in Chichen Itza, these massive mounds of earth were created by their inhabitants one bucket at a time. Tons of materials were collected in woven baskets and hauled in to create these monuments. And all up and down the Mississippi River Basin, those great earthworks were built in places that the tribes gathered to trade. One of those places, just south of where the Mississippi River, the Illinois River, and the Missouri River converge, was a village called Cahokia. Now, directly across the mile-wide Mississippi River from Cahokia is another mound that will someday become St. Louis, Missouri. In fact, there were so many earthworks in this area that St. Louis earned its first nickname, the Mountain City, before it was even started. Of the natives in the area, only 5 principal tribes remained by the time white folks came to town: the Cahokia, the Kaskaskia, the Michigamia, the Peoria, and the Tamaroa. And the majority of the white men who came to this area were early French trappers following the Mississippi River down to the Gulf of Mexico. Spanish explorers had also been venturing through since the early 1500s, but none of them had permanently set up shop. Then, in 1753, a global conflict known as the Seven Years' War, or the French and Indian War, had kicked off. That can be summed up as France and Britain were fighting over North America, France was getting the snot kicked out of it, and as the war dragged on, France elbowed its buddy Spain and said, "Hey man, can you back me up here?" Spain said, "Sure, but I want that Louisiana territory for my efforts." So as the Seven Years' War drew to a close, the territory of Louisiana was very quietly transferred to the Spanish as a result of that 1762 Treaty of Fountain Blue. Most of the people who lived in this area had no idea what was going on, nor did they care. Spain and France were halfway around the world. News traveled extremely slowly in these days, and very little changed on this wild frontier when that deed to the property changed hands. In fact, most of the inhabitants didn't even know what happened. By the time of that transfer, the French had already built settlements in Cahokia, Kaskaskia, St. Genevieve, and Fort de Chartres. Fur trading was already well established in those small settlements, and the businessmen were always coming and going, looking to push the boundaries to expand their business. Now, into this picture comes the man who will someday be called the father of St. Louis, Pierre Laclede Legeste. Laclede was one of those businessmen, and he and his partner, a man named Gilbert Antoine de Saint-Maixent, had decided to open their own fur trade company. All they needed was the land to build it on. Laclede received his land grant just before the transfer of the territory to Spain, and in February 1764, he and his stepson, Auguste Chouteau, selected the perfect spot for their trading post. They picked the place where the Mississippi River, the Illinois River, and the Missouri River met, right across the Mississippi from that major trading hub of Cahokia. Laclede appointed his stepson, who I would like to point out is only 14 years old at this time, to oversee the construction of the village that would become their home and their livelihood. He assigned 30 settlers to help him. Laclede then went off to New Orleans to finish his trading business, leaving the 14-year-old in charge. Construction began in 1765, and within the year, the small village consisted of several homes and outbuildings, and a great big trading post that would be used to house his trappers and to facilitate his fur trade transactions. Laclede and Chouteau named their trading post St. Louis, after their benefactor, King Louis IX of France. Remember that secret deed transfer between France and Spain? It's about to matter. The French governors very quietly packed up their belongings and were recalled to France after that transfer took place, and the Spanish government sent their own people to manage the new territory. Since the majority of the white men in the area around New Orleans were French trappers and traders, and the new Spanish governor was kind of being hard-nosed, trying to make a name for himself, tensions started rising. In fact, in 1767, the people of New Orleans staged an uprising that lasted for almost 2 full years before the Spanish governor finally got things under control. But by then, many of the disgruntled French trappers were like, "That's it, I'm moving to St. Louis." So, St. Louis was transferred to the Spanish in 1770, and very few people cared, because, for one, the Spanish governor there was less of a jerk. But secondly, most people just went about their business. There were Spanish settlers coming into the small village, of course, but that had been happening for a while, so it was no big deal. So now the demographics of St. Louis is French trappers, Spanish settlers, and a whole lot of indigenous residents from all the nations, all living side by side in this town. To the east is civilization in the British 13 colonies, and to the west, unspoiled, untamed wilderness. And this is where St. Louis gets its second nickname, the Gateway to the West. I'd like to point out something here. The Mississippi acted like a natural barrier, a baby gate, if you will, keeping the British colonists on the east side of the river. But all too often, those colonists would slip across and try and set up shop on Spain's side, and Spain was not happy about this. In fact, on more than one occasion, the colonists were forcibly expelled back from whence they came. Later, when the colonies split from the British government, the Mississippi River would continue to act as a barrier. Remember this for later. Within a few years, representatives from the British and French and Spanish governments were all visiting St. Louis, trying to protect their interests in the area. The population had grown from 31 French trappers and less than 100 natives to about 700 inhabitants by this time. Back east, the American colonists were multiplying like rabbits, and they needed more land. So they asked the Spanish for land west of the Mississippi. Spain said no. Then, the colonists decided to throw off the yoke of the British monarchy, and the nation descended into chaos that we call the American Revolution. On May 26, 1780, the British Crown instructed the governor of Fort Michilimackinac, a man named Patrick Sinclair, to gather the loyal fur traders and to recruit any faithful natives he could find for an expedition against St. Louis and the American town of Cahokia. all told, they recruited about 24 trappers and just over 1,200 indigenous people, and they started making the plans for their attack. The force would be divided into two halves, one half attacking St. Louis on the west side of the river, while the other half clobbered Cahokia on the east side. Here's the problem with that theory. Those tribes were all faithful to the British government as long as they were getting paid. But they had no such loyalty to each other. Of those 1,200 or so warriors, each nation had a history with the other nations. For example, the Ojibwa had a very long and troubled history with the Sioux. The Sauk and Meskwaki warriors were 250 strong, but not necessarily thrilled about taking orders from an Ojibwa chief. The Wapasha tribesmen made great efforts to hold all of these nations in check and to keep everyone playing nice with each other. And for the most part, they did an excellent job. Now, St. Louis at this time is a trading town in the middle of nowhere. It consisted of mostly civilians and not a whole lot of military support. Of the 170 or so men in the militia, most of them were young and inexperienced. And those 170 men were also spread out over a huge area of land, making them pretty much useless for defense of the town itself. The man who's governing this town is a man named Fernando de Leyva. He's a captain in the Spanish army. He had been tipped off that the attack was coming, and he hastily began planning a line of defense. His plans included the construction of four stone towers that would give defenders a better line of sight and could house a few four-pound cannons. The town treasury didn't have the funds to cover the project, and Leyva didn't have enough time to go to New Orleans to get more money. So he asked the people who lived there to fund it, and they did. In fact, he even paid a pretty substantial chunk out of his own pocket. And by mid-May in 1780, the first of those towers was complete, standing almost 40 feet high and almost 30 feet in diameter. It housed 3 4-pound cannons and 2 6-pounders, and even more cannons were placed along a series of trenches that snaked around the grounds. Leyva named his little defense Fort San Carlos. Remember that this village is on the fringe of civilization. They can't just roll up to the next town and pick up their order of lead projectiles, or phone in an order of rations for their defenders. If they want or need something, they must depend on themselves to provide it. And these town folk pulled off a serious accomplishment. I wonder if Leyva was impressed with how the townsfolk had all stepped up and pooled resources and worked through the nights to make preparations for this impending attack. Leyva organized the inexperienced military men and the hardy, headstrong townsfolk into the best defenders he could muster in what little time he had. He also very wisely worked out a partnership with the American troops at Cahokia that said the two cities would come to each other's aid if needed. Which is exactly why the Brits wanted to attack the two towns simultaneously, so they couldn't help each other. On May 25th, long before the other three towers were even started, the attackers came into view, and Leyva sent them a 4-pound warning shot as they neared the trenches. Some of the natives fell back, not so eager to be blown to smithereens. And all those fractious histories between the tribes suddenly became a serious problem. The Sauk and Meskwaki fell back, and some of the other tribes started grumbling about them being cowards and traitors. The Sioux and the Wapasha spent many, many long hours desperately trying to draw the defenders out into a full-on fight. The attackers were exhausted and close to dropping. The invaders tried everything to pry Leyva and the St. Louisans out of their tower, even going so far as kidnapping and publicly torturing several of the St. Louis residents who lived on the outskirts of town, which completely incensed the defenders, but Fernando Leyva kept them under control. Every time the attackers would get close, Leyva would let them have a taste of iron and lead. Eventually, after infighting exploded amongst their ranks, the invading force tired of the stalemate, and they withdrew north, burning and pillaging and plundering as they went. On the American side of the river, the other half of the invaders had been soundly defeated, partly because of the 160 or so defenders, and partly because of George Rogers Clark's reputation. Clark was a surveyor from Virginia who had made quite a name for himself in the Virginia militia. He was a man of imposing stature and imposing attitude, and the smart soldier stayed on his good side. His enemies feared him terribly. And it just so happened that he was going to Cahokia for business and arrived shortly before the attack commenced. Word quickly spread that it was Clark who was leading the defense forces, and the attackers were so freaked out, they decided not to push their luck. They were run off in short order. Fernando Leyva was seen by his superiors to be a hero, and was promoted to the rank of lieutenant colonel for his valiant efforts. Unfortunately, he died a month after the battle, and since the news and mail were so slow in these days, he never actually saw his promotion. Additionally, the townsfolk were so irate that he had taken credit for the whole defense and hadn't publicly acknowledged all of their own efforts. Nobody really cared that he died. By the late 1700s, Spain was feeling the repercussions of spending so much money to help the Americans in their revolution, and then to help the French during theirs. Spain was strapped for cash, and financially exhausted. They were also tired of trying to keep those slippery Americans from crossing the Mississippi River and settling on their property. So even though they didn't want to give up such a huge swath of fur-rich land in North America, they didn't really have much choice. And in 1800, the Treaty of San Ildefonso quietly transferred most of the lands in the Louisiana Territory back to the man in charge of France, a guy you might have heard of named Napoleon. The irony is that Spain made Napoleon give a cross your heart and hope to die promise to never, ever, ever let those sneaky Americans across the Mississippi River. And since France was staring another war with Britain in the face, their colonies were in full revolt, and the cash box was empty, Napoleon looked over at Thomas Jefferson and said, "Hey man, I just picked up a nice chunk of Gulf Front property. Do you want it?" And in 1803, the Louisiana Purchase meant that all of that beautiful territory became part of the United States. It cost $15 million in 1803 money, for around 530 million acres. Which comes out to about 3 cents an acre, and it would be equivalent to about $365 million today. According to the legend, on the day of transfer of the territory to the United States, St. Louis flew under three flags in one day. First the Spanish, then the French flag, then the American flag. Now, for the past 40 years, this town has been built by the fur traders and their families. Traders would collect the furs from local trade networks, or run the trap lines themselves, bundle it all up, ship it down to the Gulf, and then sent to Europe to be sold. So the industries that grew up in this young town supported the fur trade almost exclusively, like tanneries and the creation of flatboats. These flatboats were exactly what you would imagine. A big flat-bottom boat that was used to transport people, supplies, and fur bundles from St. Louis down to New Orleans. These boats could only run during the day, lest they strike rocks and sink during the night and lose a very expensive cargo. And they were usually a one-way vessel, meaning they were built in St. Louis, poled or rowed down south to New Orleans over a six-week period, then dismantled to recycle the lumber. It was easier to cart the lumber north over a three-month trek and rebuild the boat upriver than it was to pull it back up the river. And since 6 weeks was a long time to be watching the water flow past, the flat boatmen would fill their hours by playing cards, drinking, gambling, and oftentimes fighting over those gambling losses. In fact, the famous author Mark Twain once said that the flat boatmen raised considerable hell in St. Louis, but that the city was built on their backs. But arguably, one of the most influential pastimes that these flat boatmen had was the playing of fiddles, banjos, and other instruments to while away the hours. It's because of this mix of nationalities and musical diversity that music would become so important in St. Louis and New Orleans. This is the birthplace of the jam session. But as with everything, the advancement of technology would change St. Louis in a major way. In fact, when the first steamboat pulled into the docks in 1817, most of the 3,000 inhabitants came out to witness the birth of a new industry. And most of the Native Americans ran away thinking it was a fire-breathing dragon. She was called the Zebulon Pike, and it was a private vessel of John Jacob Astor's American Fur Company. This new ability to get from New York City to the middle of the country in less than 6 months without the grief and expense of overland expeditions was going to be a serious game changer. And in the ancient's own words, what he saw was nothing short of miraculous. It blew his mind how clean and orderly the city was. 8 broad, neat streets ran parallel to the Mississippi River, with another 23 running perpendicular. The buildings were in orderly rows of brick and wood, with more than 600 neat little houses scattered around the settlement. The city provided for itself, with all of the civilized services being found in an otherwise uncivilized wilderness. Astor's agent was also blown away by how diverse and inclusive St. Louis's people were. Children could switch from speaking Osage to French, to English, to Creole, to the Sioux language without batting an eye. It didn't matter what race or nationality you were. If you lived in St. Louis, you were equal to all others. Unless you were a slave, of course. The introduction of the steamship into this equation was about to change the face and the footprint of St. Louis. By 1818, just 1 year later, new churches had sprung up representing the Catholics, the Baptists, the Episcopalians, the Methodists, and the Presbyterians. In 1 year, there was a large new courthouse, 3 auctioneers, 3 weekly newspapers, 13 doctors, 27 attorneys, and countless other businesses. There were hairdressers, confectioners, 2 full fire companies, 5 pool halls, and 2 Negro sales offices. A new steamboat company was built on the waterfront, and the docks were overhauled to take in more steamships, and something similar to a modern-day distribution center was built to handle that influx of cargo. And all that was happening before St. Louis even became famous. Once the territory became the property of the United States, and Thomas Jefferson created the Corps of Discovery, Meriwether Lewis and William Clark would bring a whole new level of fame to this little settlement. And while the population would remain predominantly French for another few decades, people from the East Coast began to emigrate to this beautiful new land. Businessmen began expanding their companies into the area to serve that growing population. And this gateway to the vast wilderness west of the Mississippi was given a new nickname, the Empress of the Fur Trade. New supply and sundry businesses sprang up overnight. Fur traders began making their base of operations in the town. Manuel Lisa of the Missouri Fur Company moved into an office in the city. William Sublette and his brothers were running about the town as teenagers. And the soon-to-be-famous trader Pierre Chouteau, who was in fact the nephew of St. Louis's founding father Auguste Chouteau, was born into the fur trade here. New businesses continued to migrate into St. Louis, like Jacob and Samuel Hawkins' new gun shop. According to the 1821 city directory, a traveler could stay at the Green Tree Inn for $4 a week, which included all your room and board and your livery care. In 1822, William Henry Ashley and Andrew Henry took out an ad in the local newspaper, recruiting young trappers and hunters to join their new fur company, which is commonly referred to as Ashley's Hundred. When the two men sold off their assets to their employees, the Rocky Mountain Fur Company was born here. Ashley also created a supply network with local sundry companies to provide the trade goods that those trappers desired. St. Louis incorporated as a city in 1823. During the 19th century, St. Louis grew into an important center of commerce and trade, attracting thousands of immigrants eager to find a new life on the edge of the frontier. And here, another of her nicknames is born, the Queen of the Mississippi. Between 1830 and 1860, the population exploded with the arrival of many new immigrants, Germans and Irish were the dominant ethnic groups settling in St. Louis now, especially in the wake of the German Revolution and the Irish potato famine. To give you an example, in 1833, just 18 German families lived in St. Louis, according to the census records. 4 years later, more than 6,000 Germans called St. Louis home. Slavs, Poles, Greeks, Irish, you name the nationality, they came. So many of the indigenous Americans settled in these towns as well. The Seminole, the Delaware, the Creek, and many of the various Illinois tribes. In fact, the population of St. Louis multiplied exponentially. From just over 10,000 in 1820 to 14,000 in 1830 and 36,000 in 1840. And while the fur trade was declining by 1840, the other businesses were taken off like gangbusters. Many of the old fur trappers and traders had retired to a quiet life in St. Louis, happy to live out the rest of their days in civilized comfort surrounded by friends and family. Then something terrible happened. For much of early 1849, St. Louis and her nearly 70,000 inhabitants had been battling a cholera epidemic that killed more than 4,000 people. To make matters worse, on May 17th, St. Louis went up in flames. The crew of the steamboat White Cloud had moored at the north end of the docks. They had doused an earlier mattress fire and they were airing the mattress out on deck. Seeing no evidence of a fire, they dragged it back into the cabin and went to go enjoy themselves in town. But they had missed an ember. Sometime around 10 p.m., flames burst from the White Cloud's deck. Watchmen stationed along the crowded docks sounded the alarm. Volunteer firefighters and residents rushed to the scene as the flames leapt from the White Cloud to an adjoining steamboat, the Edward Bates. The Bates burned quickly and it burned free of its mooring and drifted downriver as the flames fully engulfed her. As she drifted along, sharp winds blowing out of the northeast pushed the Bates and those dancing flames into all the surrounding ships. Crews who were still on their vessels tried desperately to cut their lines and escape into the current, but the winds pushed their boats back into the inferno. Before half an hour had passed, 23 ships were ablaze. One of those ships, loaded with lead and gunpowder, exploded, sending burning projectiles far into the city and scuttling most of the ships moored around her. Loose embers floated into the night sky and began to rain down on the docks. Stacks of hemp, tobacco, lumber, and other freight all quickly caught fire. More sparks wafted down on the businesses that had been shut up for the night. As warnings spread, business owners made frantic dashes to retrieve important books and papers. Desperate residents and businessmen tried to create fire breaks between burning buildings and their own. People climbed onto their roofs to kick off the falling embers. Firefighters frantically pumped the hand-powered water pumpers that had served them so well until now, but these were proving inadequate against this inferno. St. Louis had even planned ahead for a large-scale disaster, installing a water reservoir inside one of the hollowed-out Indian mounds. That water was depleted very quickly, leaving them with only the water in the Mississippi River. The flames spread south towards the wooden homes filled with sleeping inhabitants. Firefighters and residents formed bucket brigades, while low river levels hindered the attempt to use hoses to fight the flames. The conflagration would burn like this for the next 8 hours until dawn came and the winds finally died down. Only then would firefighters start to make some headway. The Great Fire destroyed more than 400 buildings, thousands of tons of freight, and killed at least 3 people, including the captain of the fire brigade. Though it's more likely, crew members asleep on the boats perished without anyone ever knowing. 15 full city blocks on the St. Louis River District were utterly destroyed. There is actually a daguerreotype photo of the aftermath that I've put up on the fursandfrontiers.com website showing what it looked like in the aftermath. It looks like a modern-day war zone. Within a decade, the city was well on its way to rebuilding, this time with stricter building codes and fire breaks being implemented. And by 1859, the population of almost 200,000 residents were witness to the thriving steamboat trade being conducted up and down the Mississippi. It was not heard of to have 2,000 or 3,000 steamboats waiting to dock, sometimes tied up for 2 or 3 rows deep. A steady stream of people and luxury goods were flowing upriver into the city, while thousands of tons of materials were flowing back down the river to New Orleans. From St. Louis, wagons laden down with the trade goods and supplies were worming their way into the wilderness, southwest across the Santa Fe Trail, and northwest into the remote regions of the Rocky Mountains. It is from here that the Rocky Mountain Fur Trade Rendezvous was fed. Wagons crept away from the docks, hauling out the grocery supplies for the residents. Wagons also crept back into the docks, waiting to be reloaded with more supplies. And in 1859, the first horse trolley was in use. And you know what all of this congestion created? Road rage. The newspapers of the day lamented at the overcrowding, at how the entire economic system would collapse if they didn't address these terrible, terrible traffic jams immediately. Which just goes to show you, modern media-driven hysteria is not a new problem. Now, St. Louis was primarily a slave state, and many of the residents were Southern sympathizers. But because of its strategic location and the fact that so many anti-slavery Germans lived there, it stayed firmly under Union control during the Civil War. By the time the American Civil War started, St. Louis had become a beating heart of supply and demand in the American West. They produced vast amounts of grain and other staples, so that when the war started and the government was looking for someone to make hardtack to feed the soldiers, St. Louis stepped up. Barrels of hardtack crackers began to stream out of St. Louis and into the hands of the everyday soldier. St. Louis also produced 7 iron-plated gunships called the Turtle for General Ulysses S. Grant. And they did it in less than 100 days. That was a major feat of achievement back in this day. But the inhabitants of the city were still divided, like so many states during this conflict, over the subject of slavery. 16,000 signed up to join the Union Army, and 5,000 signed up with the Confederates. During the conflict, St. Louis would not only house a state-of-the-art hospital for Union soldiers, but almost 40% of the ammo for the states of Missouri and Tennessee. And this is where St. Louis gets her final nickname, the Arsenal of the Union. After the Civil War, St. Louis continued its rapid growth, partially thanks to the new rail systems that were snaking their way around the city. During the Civil War, though, many of those railroads avoided St. Louis because of the dangers of the war, and instead they turned their travels towards Chicago. To counter the lack of supply transportation in the city, St. Louis revived the steamboat trade during the Civil War, and this time they built bigger and better crafts. The new boats had 40-foot paddle wheels and could carry even more freight and passengers. Crew members started wearing snazzy new uniforms and putting on a good show to please the passengers. Boys as young as 9 could get a decently paid full-time job as a porter. And the industries took off again. But as the rail systems returned and the technology advanced, the Mississippi River, that once served as the lifeblood of the city, that highway, now became a hindrance. It was far too wide to bridge across, and nobody seemed to know what to do about it. Enter a brilliant St. Louis civil engineer and inventor named James Buchanan Eads. As he came from modest beginnings, he was largely self-educated. As a boy, he'd gotten a job at a dry goods store to help support his family. The owner took a liking to the kid and let him hang out in his personal library when he wasn't working. So Jim read every book about science, mechanics, and machinery that he could get his hands on. And by 1867, he had figured out how to build a rail and road bridge that would span the Great Mississippi River. Not only was it the first large bridge to use steel as its primary component, but it was also the longest arch bridge in the world at the time of its completion. He was also the first bridge builder to employ the cantilever method, which meant that the boats could continue to use the river the whole time he was building it. And the whole time he was building it, he was laughed at. People called his project Ede's Folly. Sadly, 10 men died in the making of the bridge, which did not win Jim Ede's any popularity contests. But when it was all said and done, and for the next 10 years, engineers from all over the world came to St. Louis to see just how he did it. Unfortunately, that magnificent creation was the death knell for the steamship industry. But St. Louis would go on to have many firsts. In 1809, a physician named Antoine Sagrain was the first to vaccinate the residents using Edward Jenner's new cowpox vaccine. He gave it to everyone. It didn't matter what color they were or whether they could afford to pay for it. The first public kindergarten was founded in St. Louis in 1873. A woman named Annie Turnbow Malone invented the first hair products for black women in 1902. And in 1929, the drink 7-Up was created. In 1928, a pharmacist invented an antacid to treat his wife's indigestion, called Tums. It's also the home of the first dedicated gas station, built in 1905. But one of the city's greatest moments came the year before, in 1904, when it hosted the World's Fair. The Olympic Games were held in conjunction with the World's Fair, and more than 20 million people toured St. Louis during that 7-month-long event. It was at this World's Fair that it said Baker Ernest Hamwi wrapped his waffle pastry into a cone when the vendor next to him ran out of dishes to put his ice cream in. Now, for those of you who do not attend the Black Powder Rendezvous, I want to take a moment and tell you a little something about living historians. When we set up at these events, one of our greatest joys is when the sun goes down. People began to gather around someone's campfire. We tell stories and jokes. We get to reconnect with old friends and maybe make a few new ones. And one of the greatest things about this time is when all the instruments come out. The music flows out across camp and into the night, inviting people to follow that sound to friends and fellowship. And for that moment, it doesn't matter if you're French or German or American or black, brown, or white, or rich, or poor. We are all equals, celebrating that community that we've created. The community that honors the fur trade. I believe that this aspect of the rendezvous that we love so much started right here. It was the flatboatmen who spent 6 boring weeks floating down to New Orleans that began the tradition of jam sessions. I'm sure it happened elsewhere before this. Couldn't have been the first time in history. And I'm sure that somewhere a group of cavemen got together and smashed rocks together in harmony. But the influence of the European and African instruments and the Native American rattles and the Irish drums and the Italian invention of the piano and the Middle Eastern invention of the trumpet, that is what created a music scene in St. Louis that was like no other. And it's because of this musical melting pot that the magnificent musicians like ragtime great Scott Joplin traveled there to discover his sound. Josephine Baker, Chuck Berry, Donny Hathaway, and even Tina Turner all found their sound in St. Louis. And it's because of all those influences that jazz was born and that New Orleans would someday become synonymous with that sound. The gateway to the West, the Empress of the Fur Trade, the Arsenal of the Union, St. Louis has been called by many names. Today, the St. Louisans proudly use the tagline Opportunity Central. And if you think about it, that's really fitting. It was the birthplace of so many aspects of the fur trade. And it was the place where it eventually died. I thank you all for coming along with me on this trip through the history of St. Louis. You can find many more episodes like this, discussing the great trappers like Jim Bridger and Jed Smith, or controversial figures like Simon Girty, or the birth of grand cities like New York, by visiting the website at fursandfrontiers.com. Please check out the resources page for quick links to all sorts of historical data, and some really amazing websites for the North American fur trade era. As always, thanks for listening, and check back again in a few weeks for our next episode. Until then, have a great weekend, everybody, and keep your powder dry.